I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, hypnosis, the placebo effect, TM, the power of positive thinking, will go inside mind-body medicine. But first, the Federal Reserve and two other agencies under fire for not doing enough to help consumers will propose regulations today that would ban some of the worst practices in the credit card industry, those retroactively or arbitrarily raised interest rates, deceptive offers, unfair fees. Congress is also considering legislation, but these Fed rules are the toughest in decades against credit card issuers, who rake in about $15 billion every year in penalty fees, another $17 billion in overdraft fees. Joining us, Kathy Kristoff of the Los Angeles Times. Kathy, consumers testified before Congress about some of these abuses. Give us an example.
Well, you know, one gentleman testified that his wife was a couple hours late making a payment, made it online, but because she missed their cutoff time, their rates and the rates on their credit card soared to like 32%. And the problem with rates going up on your credit card is that it goes up on your whole existing balance. So it's not like, you know, you're facing a rate hike on new charges. You're facing a rate hike on charges that you have, you know, built up before.
Carried over.
Exactly.
Well, you also read about a woman from Denver who testified that her interest rate soared because the credit card issuer decided her balances were too high. She was never late in payment. She was a good customer, but they just didn't, you know, they just thought she was spending too much money.
This is a very common complaint. Consumers say all the time that essentially what's happened in the last few years is credit card issuers will go back and check your credit report on a regular basis. If you at some point have a higher balance, if you've dropped a card, if your credit score is not what it was when they first issued the card, they will sometimes put you into a penalty rate. And again, it's on your entire existing balance.
So these rules that are proposed, what will they stop?
The rules would stop credit card issuers from raising your interest rate on an existing balance, except for in unusual circumstances,
such as
when you had a teaser rate and they told you up front, oh, you'll have this rate for 6 months and then, you know, you'll go from 9% to 15%. They would also allow the credit card issuers to raise your rates if you had done something like been 30 days late paying. That would change your credit profile for that issuer. But they wouldn't allow the credit card issuer just to look at your overall credit report and say, we think you're a higher risk, and therefore we're going to raise your rates on everything.
Well, we understand the proposal doesn't address the disclosure of terms. Hopefully it's not in those mini pamphlets with micro print that we're used to getting. What are some of the other rules that are proposed?
One of the other things that the regulations would do would be they would curb phase with these cards that people get when they're trying to rebuild their credit. Some of these cards, essentially, they give you a credit card with a credit limit, but then they charge you fees that essentially hit your credit limit. So you have a card with $100 worth of borrowing power, and they charge you upfront fees that account for $90 of your borrowing power. So now you can charge a coffee, and that's pretty much it. So the regulators would curb the fees on those, and in the instances where the fees are more than 25%, of the credit limit, they would make the credit issuer charge those fees over time.
You understand another proposal would be to stop credit card companies from applying payments to the balance with the lowest interest rate. Sometimes you have one interest rate, let's say it's high for your purchases, another one that's low for your cash advances, and so the payments are applied to the low interest rate, which, you know, so as your other one climbs, this would change that?
Yes. That's one of the big complaints that consumers have, is that they get a promotional rate. You know, transfer your balance over here, we'll give you a 2% rate or a 0% financing. And so they transfer the balance over, and then their new charges are charged at a different rate. But when they try and pay the bill, the bank will apply all of the payment to the lowest rate balance and will not allow them to pay off the high rate balance until that low rate balance is gone.
Well, we know the banking industry isn't happy about the new rules. Some critics want to see, you know, tougher rules, for instance, restricting credit card marketing to college students. But in the meantime, what happens to these rules next? They're not automatically enacted.
Right. They go to a comment period. And One of the things that consumer advocates are concerned about is when they go into this comment period, they could be watered down dramatically in the process.
Kathy Kristoff, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Have you ever gone to a therapist to exorcise your demons? Well, maybe there is a direct line from modern therapy to exorcisms, the once common thinking that illness was due to demonic possession and a representative of God offered the cure. There is a line from CAT scans back to a belief in the 1800s that the body had a real magnetic force. Today we want to have a conversation about alternative mind-body medicine and deep historical roots that help us understand what works today. Anne Harrington traces the history in her fascinating, exhaustive new book, The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. She's a professor in the History of Science Department at Harvard University and joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what a pleasure to read. You take us through the placebo effect, the importance of group therapy, Norman Vincent Peale's power of positive thinking, stress-causing illness, prayer is healing. And I was relieved at the end to see that all of your students ask what I was going to ask, which was, what works?
Well, it changes over time, and I can tell you which techniques and approaches have their stock up at the moment and whose stock is down. But the reason I wrote A History of Mind-Body Medicine as opposed to a overview of mind-body medicine and what you should do and what you shouldn't do is that I'm very, very clear that what we believe today is only partially conditioned by the science. The religious roots of mind-body medicine continue to shape and persuade us of the power and importance of certain of these techniques.
And that even with the science, it changes. It was once thought stress produced ulcers. Bacteria produces ulcers.
That's right. Some of the ideas that we were most certain were true no longer seem as persuasive, say, at this particular moment in time. And in a year from now, it's not clear what is going to feel most persuasive, strictly from a scientific point of view.
For instance, at one point recently, the thinking was that group therapy would help reduce cancers.
Back in the late 1980s, some quite persuasive clinical data was released that suggested that women who had advanced metastasized breast cancer, who participated once a week in a 90-minute group therapy kind of a context, on average lived twice as long as those who didn't participate in this kind of an intervention. Mm. People started joining support groups. Patients started hearing that, you know, if you've got cancer, get your chemo, do your radiation, but make sure you join a support group because it's good for your health. You'll live longer. Just last September, David Spiegel, the lead author on the original 1989 article that started all of this excitement, published the replication that said he was not able, in fact, to replicate his results. Group therapy doesn't seem to extend the life expectancy of people with at least very advanced cancer.
But that may change in six
months.
That's
right. So here's an interesting thing. Why wasn't he able to replicate? And one answer that he's given is that in the 28 years since his original study, some of the biochemically based therapies for cancer have gotten better. So it's possible that there is an effect, but it's washed out by the improvement in conventional treatments. Mm. It's also possible that he wasn't able to replicate because everyone in the culture came to know that social support is good for cancer, and therefore it wasn't possible anymore to create a true control group.
Right.
I'm not in the active treatment group. I'm going to go find another form of social support because I don't want to take any risks.
And bottom line is, even though he couldn't replicate the science part of it, that the cancers were reduced, it still made patients feel better.
I tell a story in the book about going to speak to some of the women who were in the replication trial. No one had ever asked them what seemed to me quite a fundamental question, which is, what do you think of the study? Do you think that this is extending your life? And when I asked that question, a snort went around the table. And they looked at me and said, we know better. We've seen too many of us go. But then they said that, and this was the part that blew me away, they said, you know, we don't really care. That's not why we come. Well, why do they come? They said they come because in this group they learn how to live with cancer and they also learn how to die with cancer. And that's something they can learn nowhere else in their culture. And then one of the women in the group who probably thought that I was disappointed with that kind of an answer said, well, maybe one way to think about it, she said, is that if you eliminate the concept of time, then we live longer. we talk about quality of life, and it sounds like a kind of a flat thing. It's not a flat thing at all, and it's a profound thing. It's about the richness of life while you have it.
And the definition of feeling better and health.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, I think one of the interesting things about mind-body medicine, it offers at least the possibility of opening up just that thing you're saying, our definition of what healing, what cure, what health might be.
And while there have been what may be perceived as setbacks in some of the thinking, there are stories that you write about that still haunt you, and they are haunting. Can you just take us through a couple of them?
One is the story of a man named Mr. Wright, who is dying, at least by all the estimates of his doctors, of a advanced form of cancer. He has tumors, his doctors say, the size of oranges. But he's in a municipal hospital that has been selected to be a site for a clinical trial of a new experimental drug called curbiazin. And he begs and begs and begs to be allowed to participate in the trial. And even though he doesn't meet any of their criteria, he so much wants to be part of this. His doctors agree they'll give him an injection. He has an astonishing response to the injection of curbiazin, a response that blows out of the water the responses of any of the other patients given the injection that day.
His tumors melt like snowballs on a hot stove.
Then Mr. Wright hears reports that the medical profession has some doubts that curbiazin is, in fact, an effective drug, and he relapses. And now the doctors realize there's something psychologically interesting going on here, and they tell him, don't believe what you're hearing. Curbiazin, we believe, is a very effective drug. He said, well, why am I sick again? Because, they say, the batch of curbiazin wasn't fresh. It had decayed. Wait, we're getting an extra potent batch coming in. They wheel in the medicine, they roll up his sleeve, and they inject him, but not with curbiazin. They inject him with simply distilled water. And his response is more dramatic than ever. He's released from the hospital. He flies himself home in his own airplane. And then he reads a report in the newspaper from the American Medical Association that declares curbiazin, quote, a worthless drug. He relapses and he's dead 3 days later.
Oh, my God. And by the way, what would your headline of that story be? Because you put the stories into categories of positive speaking, healing ties. We spoke about the communities making
That's
us
right.
better. Which one would this fall under?
This is a story about the power of suggestion, the influence that authority figures and also symbols of authority like a syringe or a powerful drug that is coming down the pipeline have on the minds of vulnerable people.
All of these ideas, the fact that a community can heal, that a mind can make you well but also maybe make you sick,
That's right.
Freud and his hysterical paralysis, is very insulting to sick people.
It can be. I mean, one of the reasons why a lot of people don't like this stuff is there's more than one reason. One is that they think, well, science isn't very good, or people are being promised a bill of goods and they're being told that if you just, you know, think positive, you can melt your tumors away. But the other big reason why a lot of people don't like this stuff is they say it's a blame the victim. Your mind made you sick, and therefore if you can just change your mind, you can make yourself well.
But Mr. Wright initially did make himself well. How? We'll have more with Anne Harrington in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Anne Harrington, a Harvard professor who specializes in the history of psychiatry, neuroscience, and other mind sciences. Her new book is The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. Before the break, we were talking about Mr. Wright, a well-documented patient who was able to think his tumors away. The medicine he took was actually water, but he believed it cured him. It's an example of the placebo effect. And Anne, in your concluding chapter, this is something you believe in. But why could he do that and maybe someone else not? Is there maybe some genetic component to being able to think oneself well?
I don't know the answer to that question. There have been attempts to try to see whether or not there's a so-called suggestible personality type. Now, I think that suggestion works. I think that hypnosis is something that has been shown to be a very effective intervention, particularly around pain, but also around skin disorders. There's some very impressive data in the medical literature showing the impact of hypnosis on curing everything from warts to ulcers.
And by the way, hypnosis is one of the historical story line threads that you spool up for us. And you show us that through the history of hypnosis and a man named Mesmer,
right,
who would mesmerize people, he coins the phrase animal magnetism. He said he could put his hands over the body and move an energy force around. They went in and out of favor. I mean, when hypnotism wasn't being accepted as a medical cure, it became a sideshow. But then it came back.
That's one of the lessons, I think, that you can pull out of understanding the history of mind-body medicine, that before these ideas became scientific, often they had their roots in religious authoritative understandings of the ways in which healing happens, that when science declares, no, we don't believe this stuff, other kinds of groups that still command respect in the culture often take them up and continue to use them.
Entertainers with hypnotism.
Right, but they weren't simply entertainers. They continued to practice a kind of alternative or, you know, counterculture medicine in the late 18th and early 19th century. Mm-hmm. And the medical profession, don't be under any illusions, watched this very carefully and was quite nervous about this. And one of the things that happened when the medical profession then take hypnosis back and say we're going to own this is they get very busy trying to stamp out the stage mesmerist. You know, they were doing it before the medical hypnotists were doing it. But now the claim by the medical profession is that they have no business dealing with something that really belongs to us.
Yeah. A couple of the other stories that just haunt you as you write. 200 cases of blindness in a group of Cambodian women who were forced by the Khmer Rouge to witness the torture and slaughter of those close to them. Examinations found there was nothing physically wrong with their eyes, but they were blind.
And the way they put it is that we cried until we could not see.
Another case, children living in institutional settings who, you know, got the food and clothing they needed, but no nurturing, who became physically stunted and developmentally retarded.
That's right. These were studies that, particularly out of the Second World War, when there were a lot of kids were put into orphanages. Efforts at the time to look after them very carefully, particularly focused around good hygiene, not too much touching, not too much contact, had the effect of actually causing them to fail to develop properly, to become retarded because they didn't have any secure attachment.
The case of the women who cannot see would seem to be under the body that speaks.
That's right. This is the narrative strand in the history of mind-body medicine that says there's a relationship between the kinds of traumas that we carry inside our hearts and in our unconscious and the specific kinds of symptoms that we manifest on our bodies.
Well, that you know, the body that speaks gets confusing. It's one of the many places where it's not so black and white, because, for instance, Freud found that patients with repressed thoughts could make themselves sick. But on the other hand, women who were truly sick were often told, oh, it's just in your head.
That's right. So these were very, very deeply burdened and ill women. And he was able, he said, to make them better. So that's not something to sneeze at. On the other hand, why, if the real problem that they were suffering from was an emotional one, why were they manifesting their distress in physical terms? Because medicine takes the physical seriously. And so by discovering the true source of their suffering, Freud in some sense seemed to be saying that that disease isn't really real, or it's real in a new way. And that has the effect of making people feel potentially like they're suffering a second-class illness.
There is so much in the book. Qigong, TM, the look towards the East, Norman Vincent Peale's power of positive thinking after decades of just, you know, treating body without the mind, just so much of the history and so much of modern day. Anne Harrington, what's your conclusion as to how people should go forward?
One conclusion would be to understand all the ways in which these ideas are important, not just as techniques that people use to make themselves maybe well or better, but also as approaches that people embrace in order to express other kinds of discontents. Discontents with maybe the inadequacy of the relationship they have with their primary care physician, or discontents with the way in which the healthcare system in our own time doesn't make enough room for the whole person.
Well, I feel I've waited long enough. Now I can ask you again, what works?
I think that people should take seriously, maybe even more seriously than they often do, certain kinds of simple hypnotic techniques, biofeedback. Very good for incontinence, by the way. It's one of the, you know, people who take all of these quite serious medications for their incontinence might consider biofeedback certain kinds of simple meditative techniques. I don't think you should necessarily turn to meditation or yoga as a alternative to chemotherapy and radiation if you've got cancer, but it might be a very good way for you to cope with some of the side effects of the treatment. There's very good epidemiological evidence that people who maintain close relationships or are embedded in a community over the course of their lives, on average, are more resistant to some of the great serious disorders like heart disease and cancer than those who are more socially isolated. Mm-hmm. What doesn't seem to be, at the moment, it could change, but what doesn't seem to be quite as persuasive at the moment is this idea that after you're already gravely ill, that you can use friends to slow down the course of your disorder, that you can use love as a kind of medicine. But of course, love when you're ill and social support when you're ill is profoundly important in all sorts of other ways. So the message isn't, of course, mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. shouldn't seek social support when you're right. ill. Of course, you should.
That's Anne Harrington. Her book is The Cure Within, A History of Mind-Body Medicine. Professor Harrington, thank you so much. Just fascinating. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, after the news, where are the summer jobs for teenagers here and now? The end of the school year is coming, time for teens to start looking for a summer job. But a study by the website snagajob.com found half of all hiring managers aren't planning on hiring seasonal workers this summer. And analysts expect teen summer employment to drop to the lowest rate on record after last summer already set a record low. Why? Well, we're going to take a look at the summer job situation nationwide, but let's start in the city of Boston. Mark Eisenberg is the Vice President of Workforce Development and Technology Services at Action for Boston Community Development, or ABCD, that was set up specifically to find and subsidize jobs in the public sector for young people. In the 70s, they gave out 6,000 jobs. This year, they're offering 1,000 because they rely on state and philanthropic funding. Mark, how would you put a headline on this?
Certainly, we're seeing an increase in the number of youth that are seeking employment this year. We're seeing more older youth than ever before, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds. And older youth generally is an indication that they're having difficulty finding jobs in the traditional retail market here in Boston.
So they're going to try to get a summer job. We're hearing that kids are competing in many places with their parents for these jobs, that part of the reason that more kids are looking for jobs is that the economy's hit their family.
Certainly. And what you will generally find when you walk into any retail establishment, you are finding older workers who are doing jobs post-retirement, and you are also finding college students doing jobs that historically were done by high school age students.
Well, there's a little disconnect, though, because we also know that the federal government has not given out as many seasonal worker visas as it has in the past because of the war on terrorism and, foreign workers. So aren't there jobs, on Cape Cod, waitressing jobs that traditionally went to, you couldn't get kids to take them. Aren't there jobs like that that are now available for teens?
I generally think that you're seeing maybe pockets of that. However, the kinds of kids that are coming to us are predominantly 14, 15, 16-year-olds who don't really have access, mm-hmm. who require a lot more supervision than is afforded in those kinds of jobs.
Right. Well, this is a different aspect of the teen job crisis, if you can look at it as that, because you receive funding for your agency, pay teenagers directly for their work in a variety of different public sector jobs. So what has happened? Is the federal government cutting back on your funding?
Really, the federal government abandoned summer employment as a specific line a number of years ago. And as a result, we've had to rely on state funding as well as philanthropic funding.
It sounds like a vicious cycle. Even an agency like yours, whose goal is to get kids to work in the summer, it relies on funding from either the state or from philanthropists, people who want to give you money. But with the economy bad, money's tight, so you're not getting the money to put kids to work.
Certainly money is tight, and generally we're seeing the philanthropic sector being hard-pressed to deliver across the board, and certainly true on summer jobs. But I still remain very hopeful that in the end people will come through.
That's Mark Eisenberg. He's Vice President of Workforce Development and Technology Services at Action for Boston Community Development here in Boston. We call it ABCD. Mark, thanks.
Thank you.
And let's turn now to Joseph McLaughlin. He's a research associate at the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University, co-author of a study on the summer labor market that was released earlier this year. So, Joe, Mark Eisenberg tells us his agency is getting more applications but struggling to get funding. Expand that out. What have you found nationally?
Last summer marked a 60-year low in terms of the teen summer employment rate. It was only 34.4%, and each year we do a prediction of what the upcoming summer will be, and we feel that teen summer employment rate will set a new low this coming summer.
Why? What's happening?
There's a variety of forces that are at play here that affect teens. The big one for this coming summer is that we have a deteriorating national economy. That really hurts teens' employment prospects during the summer months because they tend to be lower in employers' hiring queue. So the older workers that take a lot of these jobs in retail, they have work histories behind them. They're less likely to call it sick. And teens really need the strong labor market conditions so that employers really don't have a choice. They have to start hiring some of these younger kids.
Well, and Joe, what do you think is the truth when it comes to the immigrant labor force? You know, it's said that immigrants are pushing teens out of the sort of low-paid, low-skilled jobs that teens traditionally took. But on the other hand, you know, employers are saying, no, it's that teens won't take those jobs.
What we found is that illegal immigrants and low-skilled immigrants have really taken a lot of the jobs in construction, in low-skilled manufacturing, even in fast food in some instances, that would go to teens, particularly male teens. So I think the male teens have been one of the hardest hit in areas where there is a high degree of immigrants.
But is that really true? I mean, you talk to most people in suburban America, they can't find a kid who will mow their lawn.
In the suburban areas, teens have done a little bit better finding jobs. What you find is that the more affluent white teens have the highest work rates among anyone in the country. So from that standpoint, they might have a little bit more luxury on where they could choose to go work. In the bigger inner cities, the urban areas, teens are really can't get any job, and they'll try to take anything. I think they've been hurt by this competing force of low-skilled immigrant labor.
So you don't agree with the thinking that, you know, especially in the urban areas, it's that kids won't take those jobs?
I don't. And one of the big reasons I don't is that when we run programs like what Mark does at ABCD is that there's an overwhelming demand among young kids for these jobs. There's more kids that want the jobs than they have the spots for them. So I think that's a good sign that kids really do want to work.
Let's expand from some of these, low-skilled jobs. A lot of teens are looking for higher-skilled jobs, things that can be entry-level to a career. And we understand some of these kids are sending out 30, 40 resumes to get that office assistant job, and they're not getting them.
It's very competitive. The teens that have the best opportunities for those jobs are ones that kind of rely on their networks a little bit. You know, their uncle helps them get a job, and that's you find that those that are in more career-oriented jobs, those that get out there in April and May and work their family contacts, will have a much better chance of getting a job that might enhance their ability to get a better job down the road.
And another thing we're hearing anecdotally is that more and more teens want jobs because they're just starting to drive and they can't afford the gas.
Absolutely. The cost of living is higher. You can't rely on a $10, $15 a week allowance and drive around town because you're not going to be able to afford to.
Well, there's a section of your study called Why Should We Care? So why should we care about teen unemployment?
What we found is that the teens that aren't working now typically come from low-income families, and a lot of them would benefit from having some job experience. It tends to help them stay more focused in school and help them figure out what they want to do in the future. So the more teens work today, the more they'll work in the future and the more they're going to earn, even into their early 20s.
And be part of a, you know, better economy.
Absolutely.
Joe McLaughlin, research associate at the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. If you had to give one tip to, a young person looking for a job this summer, what would it be?
I think the one tip would be to start early.
Yeah. Well, Joe should know. He was co-author of a study on the summer labor market. It was released last month. Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
And here are some of the stories we're working on for next week on Here and Now. The Fonz. When he took out a library card, millions of kids started reading. Now the Fonz, Henry Winkler, is talking about his own reading disability, hoping kids will read the fun books he's writing about it. Also, why are terrorists more educated than many Americans they have to be to go high tech? We'll hear about the status of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden from author Peter Bergen. That's all next week. Coming up today, filmmaker Errol Morris. You're listening to Here and Now. North Carolina's Republican Congressman Walter Jones must have known he was in for a tough re-election when his picture was taken off the wall at Cubby's Diner in Beaufort. Cubby's was the birthplace of Freedom Fries in the days before the Iraq War. Jones championed that cause. In fact, he brought Cubby's and Freedom Fries to Capitol Hill in a symbolic protest of French opposition to the war. But since then, Jones has turned against the war, turning many of his constituents against him. Now above the grill at Cubby's hangs a banner for Jones' opponent in Tuesday's GOP primary, Joe McLaughlin. The contest gives us insight into an internal struggle in the Republican Party. Barb Barrett is a reporter with the Raleigh News and Observer. Barb, Jones has served 7 terms. He's a giant. He won the general election in 2006 by 38 points. He seems to be in the mainstream, with new polls showing a majority of Americans against the war. So what are people saying about him in his district?
Well, Jones comes from a very conservative district that covers much of eastern North Carolina. He's part of the state's political royalty. His father, Walter Jones Sr., served a quarter century in Congress, and then he was in the state house, first as a Democrat, then switching over to Republican. He is a conservative man. He is a very religious man, and a lot of people were really upset at his change of heart, especially a couple of years ago when he first came out. They thought that this was betraying the troops, betraying his president and the Republican Party. And even now, even as support for the war has waned, there are a lot of people, especially Republican activists in the 3rd District, who are still very upset with Congressman Jones.
Well, and the owner of Cubby's is quoted as saying that Walter Jones abandoned him, hopped on a bandwagon, and then when the heat got turned up, he hopped off.
Exactly. That is emblematic of some of the views that you're going to see in parts of the 3rd District.
Well, and his opponent, Joe McLaughlin, a former Army Ranger in a district that's home to Camp Lejeune and other military bases, seems to, you know, really be taking advantage of this. I mean, across the country, the economy is the number one issue, but it sounds as if in this district, the war is.
Certainly the war is very close to people in this district. Joe McLaughlin is also the county commissioner, a county commissioner for Onslow County, which is home to Camp Lejeune. He says that when Walter Jones turned against the war, he turned against McLaughlin's constituents and that he takes that personally.
Yeah. Well, if Jones does lose, he won't be the first whose position on the war has cost him. Republican Congressman Wayne Gilchrist lost his party primary in February because of his opposition to the war. So there may be something going on, in particular on the Republican side, where people may be against the war, but they don't want their representatives to turn their back on the war.
That's true. On the other hand, I have talked to people here in the district who, because Walter Jones has been here for so long, because he comes from such political royalty here, may disagree with him about the war, but still plan to vote to reelect him.
Could it be that Walter Jones didn't just turn on the Iraq War? He was very angry when he found out that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But he also, you know, went on sort of a media blitz with very liberal Democratic Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. They were touting their legislation for withdrawal from Iraq within 16 months. Could it be that he went so far to the other side in the eyes of his constituents?
That's part of it. McLaughlin says that it's not just Jones' opinions, it's the company he keeps. He has met with Cindy Sheehan, and he has been supported in part by the ACLU, which has called on him to vote against Bush on other matters. And that is part of the issue. On the other hand, Jones says that now he is doing what he believes the Lord has directed him to do. He feels almost personally responsible for a lot of the deaths that have occurred in Iraq. He spends every Saturday in his district in Greenville, North Carolina, writing personal letters to families of troops killed, not only in his district, but across the country.
Well, right now, we know you're in Kinston, North Carolina, attending a Hillary Clinton rally. Does the prospect of Jones, you know, possibly being knocked out of the seat he's held for so long provide an opening for the Democrats?
It might. Marshall Adam is running against him on the Democratic side in November. He, too, is an Army vet and is against the war. And there are a lot of people, both in the 3rd District and across the state, who continue to have questions about the war, and that could bode well for the Democrats here. They say that they're going to try to put this state into play next fall and make sure that it's not necessarily a red state as it has been in the past.
Barb Barrett, reporter with the Raleigh News and Observer in Kinston, North Carolina. Barb, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, we'll have full coverage of Tuesday's primary for you. Coming up, though, Abu Ghraib through the lens of filmmaker Errol Morris. Back in 1 minute, here and now. It's been 5 years since filmmaker Errol Morris released one of his signature investigative documentaries. That was Fog of War, an intimate portrait of former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, speaking frankly about his role in the Vietnam War. It won an Academy Award. Well, Morris's new release, Standard Operating Procedure, takes on another controversial topic, those infamous photographs taken by American soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Here Now's Andrea Shea sat down with the filmmaker.
When news of the Abu Ghraib photo scandal broke in 2004, people all over the world were shocked and appalled. Pictures of young American soldiers degrading Iraqi prisoners, holding a leash attached to a man on all fours, a human pyramid stacked with naked men, and that shot of the hooded prisoner standing on a box, arms outstretched, wires attached to his fingers.
It's become the iconic picture of torture and abuse. Reprinted again and again and again and again.
That's filmmaker Errol Morris. He says that notorious picture and thousands of others taken at Abu Ghraib don't tell the full story. Instead, they raise questions about what happened outside the frame. Morris set out to find answers in making Standard Operating Procedure.
I'm not talking about anything complicated here, something very simple, namely talking to the people who took them. And asking them, why did you take these pictures? What did you think you were doing? What do you think is shown in the pictures? What's going on here? To use some highfalutin language, contextualize them for me.
Specialist Sabrina Harmon took many of the famous photographs and can be seen smiling and giving the thumbs up in a lot of them. She was a prison guard who worked the night shift.
When I got there, he was in the shower. There was wires on his fingers, and he was told he would be electrocuted if he fell off. There was no electricity going through the wires, and to say, hey, if you fall off, you're going to be electrocuted, I mean, that would keep anybody awake, so it was part of the sleep plan.
The sleep plan was Standard Operating Procedure. Harmon was one of the military and civilian personnel stationed at Abu Ghraib. Errol Morris says he started his investigation of what happened at the prison, as he always does.
I worked years ago as a private detective, and my boss at the time said, the first people you should always interview as an investigator is you should interview the people who got fired, because they're pissed off, they're angry, and they're most likely to talk.
Such as Janice Karpinski. She was a brigadier general in Iraq, where she was in charge of overseeing the prisons. In the film, Karpinski says she lost her job after trying to keep the Abu Ghraib scandal from blowing up.
I was preparing in my mind to hold a mini press conference to tell the truth and to tell it early, to say, this is what we've uncovered. We're looking into it because we discipline ourselves. We're Americans, and we know right from wrong. General Sanchez said, no, absolutely not. You're not to discuss this with anyone. The fear of the truth silenced people.
Morris says he spoke with Karpinski for 17 hours over 2 days. That endurance, patience, and direct interviewing style yield candid confessional footage. Morris also uses a device called the Interitron. It's a modified teleprompter that projects the image of Morris's face over the camera lens so the interview subjects feel like they're speaking to him rather than to the camera.
We just do what they want us to do. If they want us to PT the guy, that's what we do. If they want us to keep him up, that's what we do. They say, I want him to be awake. They say, he's dirty. I want him to shower a lot.
Did any of this seem weird?
Not when you take into account that we're being told that that's helping to save lives, and you see that people are coming in from right outside the wire with their body parts missing.
The interviews are mixed with gruesome still photos, writ life-size on the big screen, and also dramatizations. Morris's reenactments are impressionistic, highly stylized, and dreamlike. Out-of-focus actors in orange jumpsuits play Iraqi prisoners. Recurring shadows move against bloodstained walls.
The photographs are all real. That's the real deal. But the reenactments, the retrospective accounts, try to help you imagine, to visualize, to understand what the world around the photographs might be like.
He makes these documentaries that are almost like found art.
Ty Burr reviews film for the Boston Globe and says standard operating procedure succeeds as an investigative piece, although he wishes more high-ranking military personnel were included. And he, like other critics, laments the absence of perspective from the Iraqis in the photos. Morris has also been criticized for paying some of his interview subjects for their time. Burr says whether or not that taints the film is academic.
I think it's open for discussion, but in the end result, I think no, not in this case. I think the strength of what they're telling, just the mass of details, almost everybody that he talks to has gotten to a point where they know there's no way they can look good. They're sort of standing beyond the wreckage of themselves, looking at it and saying, well, what the heck happened? Here's what happened.
In the end, Burr says Morris's film humanizes the demonized. Errol Morris sees the story of Abu Ghraib as a complex human tragedy. He says in his mind, there is little doubt that the lower-ranking soldiers, the ones who lost their jobs and went to prison because of the scandal, were scapegoated. But even saying that is too simple.
We say someone has been scapegoated. We think there's an argument they're lily white or they have done absolutely nothing wrong. I'm not saying that here. They did things that were wrong. But I am saying that they were scapegoated, that the pictures were misunderstood, and many of the things that we take to be evidence of the most horrible crimes in the photographs are, guess what? Standard operating procedure. They were policy. Military policy.
When you walk from the main portion of the prison and you get to 1A1B, they already had intelligence detainees down there. That's when I saw the nakedness. I'm like, hey, Sarge, why is everyone naked? You know, hey, that's the MI. That's what the MI does. That's the MI thing. I don't know. Why do these guys have on women's panties? They're like, it was to break them. The guys naked, guys in women's panties, guys in, you know, handcuffed in stress positions, you know, in isolation, cells, no lights, no windows. You open the door, turn the light on. Oh, my God, Allah. Click, turn the light off, close the door. It's like, whoa, what is that? It's like, hey, that's military intelligence. You know, just stay out their way. And from then on, it's like, something's not right here.
In fact, the military's investigation of what happened at Abu Ghraib concluded that the action in the famous picture of the prisoner on the box wasn't torture. It was standard operating procedure. But who knows if American filmgoers will want to examine the story behind the photos. Other movies about the war in Iraq have flopped at the box office. But with this meditation on photography, memory, and truth, Errol Morris's loyal fans will likely get what they're looking for: the filmmaker's unique lens on human nature. Here and Now's Andrea Shea on the new Errol Morris documentary, Standard Operating Procedure. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.